A word to the wise. This week we are discussing, as we always do, books with adult themes as well as content with explicit content. So, wow, you can tell I'm just doing this off the cuff. Part of the reason that I wanted to come on the top of the episode and redo our topper is we actually split this one into two once again. It was a 4.5 hour beastie talking about all of Sharp Ends. And instead, in this specific instance, we're just going to be talking about the subsection that I've dubbed Javra and her partner Chev, which is very exciting. That's going to be Small Kindnesses, Two's Company, Skipping Town, and Three's a Crowd. So please enjoy, listen to this episode. We really had a great time, especially catching up on the map and more. So hope you enjoy. Hey there, this is Cross.
I am PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice drinkers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
You definitely said veteran and novice drinkers alike this time.
That's fair.
I think that's
the facts.
Pretty accurate too. I think that works.
Yeah. Drinking is not required and encouraged if it's healthy for you, but you know, that's the extent of it. Reading though, pretty much required.
Yeah, that one you can't. Hard to get around that one.
I do actually. I've had a couple of friends be like, I haven't read some of the books, but I just like listening to you guys talk. And I was like, oh my God, who would do that? Not only that, but I feel bad that you don't get like the experience or whatever.
That experience, it reminds me of some of my lit classes that I took freshman year of college, where I would, instead of reading the material, stay up late playing StarCraft and League of Legends with you.
Yeah.
And then I'd just sit there like a golden retriever who doesn't actually understand English, sitting through the conversation going on about the book that we were supposed to have read.
Well done.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here.
So I assure you, listeners who have not read Sharp Ends, probably a better experience if you read Sharp Ends.
Probably a better experience. And today, like PJ said, is our episode. We're going to be reading and talking about all of Sharp Ends. I do want to start this, though, by saying that I broke this up the exact same way that I intended for us to do it as episodes. So we're still going to talk about it in that format because I do think it still makes it the most approachable sort of form to talk about it without like just kind of jumping around. I like how it's presented when you're reading it, but I do think from like a structural standpoint, I kind of like these three segments.
Yeah. So to that point, did you intend for me to read just those sections? Just those? Did you intend for me to read it front to back, or were just the Javra sections to begin with, like jumping from short story to
Before like, we made the switch,
correct.
You were going to read it in those sections. You were going to read it in those sections.
Okay.
Once we made the switch to doing in one episode, I was like, well, you can just read it linearly and then we can talk about them in the sections instead. That's part of the reason why I also, and we'll talk about this when we get there more, but what is it? Tough Times All Around was supposed to kind of be like a fun Javra and Chev come back into the situation after we had seen them kind of like leave and like end on that note. So it'd be kind of like a fun return in a weird way that like you might not be anticipating, especially because I put it last in the slots. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been fun. But yeah.
It still is.
I wonder how that experience would have been different. I don't know if it would have been.
I don't know that it would have been seriously different.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to think of if there was any information. Maybe some of the stuff with Wurin, because that Wurin comes up a couple times. Yeah. He comes up with our duo and then he comes up with Craw. So
All this to say, I don't know. Cheers though. Finished the book.
Cheers.
I'm shooting a little bit of tequila.
What are you shooting? Plantation 3-star.
Ooh, nice. Plantaray.
No. Plantaray 3-star.
I only say this because finally I had to replace the bottle. And now it's all Plantaray branded down here as well.
Yeah.
So they've churned through the inventory finally. Because like the last bottle that I bought 3 months ago was still Plantation.
Yeah, I'll have to look. My very well may be Plantar Ray. I'm sure we've talked about this at length.
Yeah, we already have for sure. But yeah, anyway, I wanted to start this off as we usually do, just getting your thoughts, getting your vibes. How do you feel about this short story? This is the first short story collection in its entirety that we've covered on the podcast. How do you feel about it?
I was caught unawares, Crossland. I didn't expect there to be any sort of through line in this.
That's one of the best things about this story.
It's such a cool experience because it doesn't feel... And the fact that there's so much connection to all of the other stories that we've read so far.
Right.
It doesn't feel like a disparate collection of stories. It feels like necessary text.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just like exploration into the corners of the First Law world so much as it is also this like central through line that is Joe's fantasy thief, you know? And that's where we're going to start, of course, is talking about Javra and her partner, Chev. But
Chevetia.
Chevetia.
We call it kind of Javra's... Like, you and I have both pointed her out as, like, the main character in this, but I think it truly is Chev's story.
It's Chev, but it's funny because she's constantly being overwritten by Javra in every scene after they first meet, basically.
She is, and
you know,
I'm okay with that.
It's so funny.
It's so funny.
Mm-hmm. But that's why I phrased it that way when I was laying out the episodes, too. I was like, oh, Javra and Chev. You know?
But yeah, exactly. I do like the name Chevetia, though.
Oh, it's great. In addition, you know, like I said, this is like Joe's fantasy thief novella, basically, that he gets to write in the middle of this, which is so much fun and does genuinely, especially the Kharkov thing that we'll talk about when we get into part two, as I have it broken up, is like so Guy Ritchie in so many different moments and segments. And it begs for adaptation. Give me the love death robots of one of these. Like, it doesn't need to be crazy. Just, you know, something. Give me a little
That'd be a lot of fun. Yeah. Chev, I mean, there's so much more we could dive into with Chev. That's the crazy thing about this quote unquote anthology of stories is that we're exposed to such deeper background to Chev than what we get, given she's had run-ins with Logan at least once. I think probably once, but
for sure when they were out, you know, out there for a while.
Yeah, but having made at least a couple different impressions, because you get the she
knives and realistic. Yeah,
yeah, you get both of those, but she. I think the realistic one, she flat out points to that scarred up northern near square deal. But the other one's just a wise man once told her. So clearly spent at least a little bit of time with Logan. She spent time with a bunch of our characters.
With Shivers.
With Shivers. With Monza.
Question. Yep. With Monza.
Probably together.
For Monza.
Yeah.
I don't think so, and I'm intrigued, and we'll talk about that when we get to maybe that story specifically. I don't think that Shivers and Monza met each other again at this point. Curious as to your thoughts, but because there is... We'll get it when we talk about that story specifically.
We get dates, and I have no idea how they line up to anything, and I did not pay attention.
Well, what's good is that, at the very least, I have a good grasp of when these things happen. The only one, I mean, obviously, that is very clearly laid out where you almost don't need the dates is when we're actually in the victims chapter of Monza's schemes, which is such a good little segment.
Yeah.
The other thing that this book provides us, though, PJ, is the world map. We've been waiting for 6 books. I'm sure you saw flashes of it as you were able to kind of look through the different pages. I believe that it is on very early. Yeah, you actually get the full map in the very front of the book. I sent the fan map that it was originally derived from, and they basically just took that man's map, paid him a bunch of money, and reformatted it a little bit, and that's it. So,
yeah.
I sent that to you in the chat. Isn't it crazy, the circle of the world?
I absolutely did not expect Styria to be where it is. I don't know why.
Fair.
I don't know. If you imagine a map of Europe, I expected Styria to be kind of where Italy is.
Super, super fair. But this is
for a good reason, I think, given the way that it's laid out in Best of Cold. But I think even before that, even before we watched or we read Best of Cold, I just had it in my mind that Gurkle was kind of further east and Styria was like southwest of that. But
well, Gurkle is always described as the south. Like
I know it is. I know
it's also
it is.
The only named continent, Kanta, which is its own thing. But
yeah.
Technically, maybe the north is the north. The northern continent is the north, but like.
Is the north Australia? The north is the north, the continent, and the north, the country.
Kinda. You know, now that I think about it, England is obviously like a joke on England, right? Yeah. Like it's kind of, but it's also attached to what is effectively like a really big Scotland, Greenland, Iceland conglomerate, you know, in a way, as I view it. Maybe even including like Scandinavia and like other countries in that realm is kind of like the whole of the north in quotes. So yeah, that makes it interesting from that perspective. Especially because like England was raided by those areas for a very long time. So it all kind of tracks from a vague historic standpoint that way.
Right.
Mitterland is just there. It's just like a little fucking island in the middle.
Just kind of.
It's just in the middle. It's Mitter. It's middle.
Joe has to feel so much relief in writing the Devils to have like an actual world to exist in.
Well, he talked about it. I listened to a number of interviews. I'm still not past part one, but he was like, it's so much easier.
Oh, this is just a map of England or of Europe.
Right. Europe. Yeah. Which Joel Daniel Phillips did as well, which was great. But yeah, what a every interview is like, it's so crazy because like I don't have to make up like names really anymore. I can just go to like history and be like, okay, that one. Cool. Sounds good. Outside of my weird elves that are like maybe cannibals. I don't know. Like that was the one kind of exception. But yeah, very, very kind of fun. Prospect. It also gives us context in like the Thousand Isles, the sides of Souljuk, just the proximity of everything. Thond being actually like huge, kind of the depth of the old empire and how far like Western. I did share the image with you, just you know, with
I can pull it up there
so
instead
you don't have to
on my book
like, fumble around with the book. Yeah, especially because it's hard to see with the crease in the middle. Like you
it
can't quite
is.
Make
yeah,
everything
that's
out.
True.
Yeah. But just like the general idea of the space, it makes it all, you know, I think like a little bit more clear. And I think it really adds something, especially when you factor in how far they went in before they were hanged. Like that's the thing that I think that we get the most benefit from the map from. Like they had to go all the way up to Alcus to make it over the mountain to then go to Shibulion.
Yeah. Did they go to the Thousand Isles? No.
No. No. A lot of people like talk about going to the Thousand Isles or being from the Thousand Isles and stuff like that. But
and Brother Longfoot talks about the Thousand Isles because he's from.
Do you think
he's Souljukian?
He's from Souljuk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But do you think they have dressing on the Thousand Isles?
No.
No. No salads there.
They eat their salads dry.
That makes sense, especially because like it would be weird to have like a Western style dressing in the East. You know what I mean? Like it would be a kind of a weird.
No.
Yeah.
They dip it in water. I'm trying to find Bale
is just north of Styria. It's that like little island
sea of Bale.
Where the sea. Yep. So it's just north. The Baelish. Yeah.
I see the sea, but is Bale?
It's that little island that is just north between it and Thond.
Okay.
Yep.
Before that little archipelago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. And the east of the Crono is way bigger than you'd think, especially when you consider the north.
Yeah, that's most of half of it.
Yeah.
That's a good bisection.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool having a map. It's fun. And unique that he was able to write such a compelling story without a map. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure many other people have done so, but it's such a staple of the fantasy genre to not have it for such a long time is really impressive. And I'm curious if there are any like inconsistencies or contradictions in the text that couldn't be resolved by an actual physical map.
No, I believe that was the one thing that they were pretty hardcore about direction wise was just making sure that like everything kind of stayed in the same place, which made it tougher for Abercrombie. He said in reviews or in interviews that like he had a map basically that it was kind of like vaguely working off of, but that it was like mostly vibes. And then his editors would double check and be like, I think that that's actually further west than you think, you know, from like a proximity standpoint. He's like, okay, whatever. And just that kind of being like the vibe out of this whole arrangement. I just don't want to spend too much longer on this, but I do want to say that like I agree with you. Maps to this point do beg a question, right? They like pose several questions to you when you open it up and you see nothing else and know nothing else of the story. So like you immediately have all these questions about all these things and you're curious about them. And when you don't get the answers in that initial book, it kind of makes you go like, huh, okay. And that's the benefit that I see in not including a map in a fantasy novel is like no questions, no expectations. There's no, maybe we're not globetrotting, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if including the map in the back of the book instead of the front would create better. I don't think it's a problem.
I don't think so either. Yeah.
But it is a different mindset to be in to have a physical map versus not.
Right. Yeah. I, for my own mental compensation, my like new target as I'm thinking about this like novella, like the books that are coming after it as I've started to scope those out, I feel like I'm going to start and I'm going to like make the map small and then like build it out as like the story reaches and touches other corners, as opposed to you getting the large map. So you just get the segments that matter until it hits, you know, whatever point. Or you assemble the map through the various pieces. So,
yeah. I mean, like, was it Best Served Cold that kind of did that? Yeah.
Yeah. The Styrian map. Yeah. And then also, I mean, like the heroes with like the relevant map of the hill and the battle and like seeing the changing forces over time. Like, what a great representation. He's had so much fun with the idea since he didn't follow the traditional path with maps. So I love that idea regardless.
Speaking of the heroes and this book, bringing it back to, I mean, I guess we're on this book because we're talking about
the map. The map is a part of this book. Yeah.
I totally expected there to be a story about the wall.
Oh, about Clails? Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No such luck.
None of it's history, though. Like, I know. That's the interesting thing. Like, none of it, I mean, I guess you could maybe
not a story about, but
the
way that you reacted to me talking about Clail's Wall during the Heroes coverage made me think, okay, we'll get some more background on it later.
That was the most Red Rising since the very beginning of us doing this project that I've ever been to you. I was like, just like, yeah, dude, you think so? Like, I was just absolutely leaning in. You know what I mean?
That's fair.
So, you know, and like,
I bought
the
it.
Danger is, of course, I don't want to. Well, yeah.
Hook, line, and sinker, dude.
I didn't.
I'm a gullible shit.
You did, but you posed the ideas and thoughts. It wasn't on me. Okay. With that, we'll get into the actual story here.
I'm gullible.
Me too, for the record. but like, maybe that's why we're friends. So with that, section one, though, just so everyone knows what we're going to talk about here. Again, I've titled it Javra and Her Partner Chev, and that includes Small Kindnesses, Two's Company, Skipping Town, Three's a Crowd. So nearly every story that they're in together is sort of this first part that we're going to talk about here.
I loved just looking at the titles of the stories before I even started reading. I saw Two's Company and Three's a Crowd. Like, they just stuck out clearly because, you know, of course they do. And I was so happy by the time I got to Three's a Crowd that they were
connected. Yeah. Again, this is our little thief story. It's so much fun. We start with Small Kindnesses, and the summaries here are a combination borrowed from the initial descriptions that were submitted by publishers and the First Law Wiki. It depends. I've kind of used the First Law Wiki as sort of the centralizing point for the short summary here. I have some other notes, but just to give kind of the overview in case you've forgotten what each short story is about for our listeners. I know you haven't because we've read this multiple times recently. This is also, I'll say, this is the First Law book that I've read the most, which, you know, it's not because it's my favorite or anything, but there's so much to pull out of these short stories. They're great for like a quick hit of joy, you know, and like when I'm trying to get into the mindset of writing sometimes, I just like will pop one in for like 10 minutes on audiobook and like listen to a segment before I like start writing just because it's so evocative in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. But Small Kindnesses, Westport, Autumn, 573. The hopes of Shvedia, the best thief in Westport, to turn her back on crime comes crashing down when she finds a huge drunkard sleeping on her doorway. Doing the right thing always comes at a price. And so she saves, of whom we eventually know to be Javra, as a part of this, but also gets kind of guilted in by old debts to steal for one of her old debtors. So what'd you make of this little story? This is very freeform.
Yeah, for sure. Had no idea what to think of Shvedia, or not Shvedia, of Java right away. Chef? Obviously, a drunkard on the patio.
Gets at a husk store, you know?
A husk store that...
Opium Chef den kind of thing, yeah.
Lives at, too, seemingly, because like she brings her to her bed. So like this is her home and her work, which just paints another...
It's like an inn.
Yeah, kind of. But paints a picture. A really bleak picture of... bleak in that this is a pretty intense thing to be facilitating. Just a husk den in general feels... like, I don't think it's an illicit drug, necessarily. Like, it seems kind of gray market-ish. Given our understanding of it in Besser Cold. I guess you need to have a connection to get it. Like she had a husk dealer, or Benna did, and thereby Monza did. So yeah, I guess an illicit drug. I don't know.
I think I agree with you more on gray markety, for the record. Like this seems like it kind of like a legal opium den. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah. That's kind of
to some degree.
And that's how it presents itself too, is it feels very opium adjacent or opium emulating the way it's described.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And the, like when she has to kick the guy out for the cries of like, as he's like sitting there crying about the death, and it's like, this is her patron that's here all the time, but it's also like, you don't want to be in here, dude. Like when this is about to go down.
And he had been in
with a Crandall.
He smoked hours ago. According to Severard, I was so excited because at this point, first read through, had no idea who Shvedia was, but I knew Severard. So I'm like, oh, we're getting Severard's like origin story. And I guess to a certain extent, we kind of do, but not really. We
kind of get the idea that he's like always had kind of like debts. We understand that like he like really cares and works deeply for people and like has like a level of investment since he was young in doing this. And then I think that you noted somewhere in here that like he moves back with his mom. Right?
Yeah.
And like that's sort of the recovery path.
Yeah. Well, Chev assumes that he'll be fine in Adjoa with his mother. Later on, like, I think it's the next story. I think it's in Two's Company, where she's...
Yeah, that sounds right.
On, like...
Because she's thinking through all the people that she's left, or, like, the life that she's left behind, and, yeah.
But here, she asks Severard to go feed his birds. So, at this point, he already has and keeps birds. Like, he's just a consistent good boy until he becomes a
Severard
torturer.
Even then, though, man, Severard's fate is so, like, so shitty comparatively, because, like, Frost is really the fucker. Like, Severard is just, like, owes a lot of debt, mostly. And so, like, he's trying to find any line of work that he can, like, pay it off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, still a torturer. Doesn't change the facts. Just like the Inquisition dudes we saw die at the end of Red Country. Doesn't change the facts.
You know? Yeah. Hard to.
You still just lit that guy on fire, and you're trying to make me sympathize or empathize with you.
It's hard
little,
to.
A little tough.
Hard to be sympathetic in general about people in that line of work. But, you know.
We also get Kharkov in addition here. Like, we get a lot of the critical characters introduced through this story for their story. So there's Javra, of course, of whom is introduced, Shev, Kharkov.
Herod? How do you say that name?
Man, you mispronouncing it totally messed me up as I was going to mispronounce it. Now I've got no clue.
It's not Harold, but it looks like, it sounds like
it's Harold. It's so close to Harold. Yeah, it's like Horold.
Horold? Horold.
Horold the finger? Something very
H-O-R-O-L-D, I think.
Yes, correct. Correct in the spelling. Harold. But his son Crandall is here. And so like we get kind of an impression of debt that like freaks Chevalier out, that then like leads her to leave because she kills him after like the job goes awry. Well, kind of goes awry. It's Kharkov's fault. But we kind of get an idea of like all of these characters that are going to be critical
right by here. The end of this.
Truly, yeah.
But
car crash's fault for sure,
dude.
I almost say my cocktail car called car crash because I was like, that's funny. But
did you ever have Kharkov vodka growing up?
Yeah. We had Kharkov specifically because you brought it because we didn't have it.
Oh yeah.
Cause we generally drank Svedka at the time, but
did you call it car crash?
Someone at the city's, it was, okay.
I could have brought it
Adam's
in too.
Fault.
Okay. Yeah.
It could have been Adam that brought it in. Yeah.
But I know that was the nickname for that specific brand of vodka at my school.
This went down way too easily and there's too much booze in this for this to have gone down too easily. So I'm going to chill out.
Fair enough.
Oh,
Crossland's going to make another cocktail.
No, I'm not. Definitely not. I'll have a beer and nurse it slowly.
No, he won't. Anyway, sorry that I was considering bringing that up at one point. Her name is spelled differently, but listening to this, which I did a couple different times, hard to shake that.
Very true. Yeah. And Kharkov is such an interesting character too. She barely gets introduced here comparatively. We get so much more into her, not in Two's a Company, but in Three's a Crowd.
We don't get who she is, but we get her importance and her emotional importance to Chevedia right away.
And we also very quickly understand that Chevedia is a lesbian, which I think is also an important thing that plays into her character. Also, I want to say, Chev, up until this point, is my favorite female Abercrombie character. Chai is incredible. Very close. Monza is also awesome. And Best or Cold is still my favorite book that I read in my adult life.
Yeah.
But
Pharaoh's great too.
Pharaoh's incredible. Artie's great. Chevedia is so funny, morbid. Like I love that character archetype. She's the second, now unfortunately because we just read Scott Lynch's, I would have said this differently, she is the second most interesting thief character that I've ever read in fiction. Unfortunately. She was first. And it's Scott Lynch's fault. But Locke Lamora, god damn it.
The Lies of Locke Lamora. And have we put that on the main feed at all?
Nope, that probably won't come out on the main feed until September. So it's going to be a bit.
Yep. So if you're interested in hearing our coverage of Scott Lynch's The Lies of Locke Lamora, you can join us on Patreon and listen to our coverage of that story. As
you tell, we liked it.
We really liked it.
Based on what I just said.
Yeah, we really liked that story.
Tomorrow,
now that we're covering Sharp Ends.
Oh, yeah.
Tomorrow, I think I should read A Little Hatred.
You should start reading A Little Hatred. Unfortunately, because of the nature of our show, I can't read anything else because I just have to fucking read these half books every week, which is great because I love these books, but also it's like, whew, I got no time.
It is, yeah.
I haven't touched The Devil's Beyond Part 1.
And it's been a couple weeks since I've read anything on The Devil's also.
Right.
But I'm physically reading The Devils. I have listened to a little bit of it, but fair. Yeah, you're right. Never mind. But I do want to read the second Lock Story. Do we have that on Audible yet?
I think I bought it already.
If okay, not, I saw it pop,
I will readily spend.
I saw it pop up, and I don't know if that was as an advertisement for buying it or if it was in the library.
It might have been an ad, but honestly, it was one of those things that I think I bought Republic of Thieves. Republic of Thieves, I think, is the next one. Red Sun, Red Sky, which is the third book, I don't think I bought yet. But
okay, cool.
Anyway, regardless.
Sorry.
It was a great time. Thieves are incredible. They do great work. Scott Lynch is great. We ranted about Minnesota author for a bit as well, which was just a fun time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So this includes a couple of incredible things. A, there's this whole like thievery scene. We get this idea of like who Chef is as a person. It's so well written. From that perspective of like her picking a lock, you know, especially because there's a nice lock joke that happens earlier where she prefers locks to knobs, which is such a funny little bit as she's kind of reflecting on all these different things. This is, we then see like Mason and Crandall of him, like Mason really doesn't want to kill her. Not a fan. Doesn't like the idea. Joe also plays around a lot just within the short story collection, hopping between perspectives of characters much more, which I love. I adore. Mm-hmm. I think he does
it
better
so
here.
Well.
Than he did in Red Country, I would also say.
I don't know. I didn't have any problem with it in Red Country. I had no issues with the way that he was jumping perspectives. So to me, this felt in line with that, and I was smitten with it.
It could just be that I still feel like I said at the end of our Red Country review, like I think that whole thing should have been like 50 to 60 pages longer. Like there was just more needed on the main character's bones to some degree, or to give us like a little bit more on Rose's perspective, like just some of those. But
yeah
stand by all that, but I love it. He does it so well. He hops around a lot here. Mason, just with this sort of like internal perspective of like, well, I don't want to kill her, like he kind of like shrugs it off and he's like, well, I guess it's just a part of the job. And then Javra comes out and is like, who saved me?
who put me in their bed?
Yeah, we just get this really strong perspective immediately on Javra.
Is she the first person from Thond that we've met?
Yes.
Yes. We've heard
and
Thond
only.
Mentioned, and I think through maybe through Wurin.
I don't remember who mentioned Thond. I don't know. I'm not 100% certain. I don't think it was Wirin.
It could be Brother Longfoot, because of course it would be Brother Longfoot.
There's a lot of just like side ranting about talking about places and things and stuff like that happens like very casually, which is a normal thing within the fantasy universe. But I know that it's been brought up a couple of times, specifically the priestesses of Thond. And so it was kind of like unclear, vaguely religious. We stopped and talked about it. I want it. My brain says it was Bestard Cold, but
one of the standalones sticks out in my brain. It sticks out in my brain that it was one of the standalones where we talked about Thond, but
yeah,
wouldn't be able to tell you with any amount of certainty.
Very conveniently, I have a nice little Kindle thing here, but regardless, to end this, she kills one of the sons of Horold, which
really sets up the stakes at the end so well. Or not, is it the end? Yeah, I guess it's the final story.
This story.
Sorry.
Thond is not mentioned in Red Country or The Heroes. It is mentioned in Bestard Cold. It's mentioned 4 times.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the first mention, but in the standalones, that's where it's mentioned.
Okay. Makes sense.
Especially given proximity. They're so much closer to Thond in Styria.
Mm-hmm.
So, that makes sense. Yeah, so we come to terms with the end of the story. We end up getting friends here. Gonna be cool.
Friends. Cool friends. Cool friends.
Yep. Cool.
Fast friends.
With that, we'll move into the story that solidifies their friendship that happens roughly 2 years later, Skipping Town. And again, the summary here, Shvedi and Javra, ill-matched adventurers, find themselves forced to flee yet another self-made disaster, which is so accurate for their friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're trash. We love that trash, though.
We love that trash. They're perfect trash. They're my trash.
Agreed. I love this friendship just in general so much as it happens and passes throughout this entire storyline. We'll get to it more a little bit later when it kind of solidifies, but it's great to see them in the near country. We kind of get this idea of like the early West as it's beginning to like settle out, and these settlements are beginning to happen leading into, you know, kind of the events of Red Country. Very interesting. We also like only got the idea that the Princess of Hoskop was, or Priestess, excuse me, was like very strong, but we didn't exactly understand it sort of like her physical barbarism. We get so much more on a character level here as she's confronted by these people as to like, not only has she been like very martially trained, but she has this like crazy sword that is a part of an asteroid, forged from an asteroid, that literally blinds and burns people.
Yeah, has some similarities. I guess the asteroid thing is the one that sticks out to me as a comparison to the way that Wirin describes the Father of Swords having fallen from the heavens.
We do get confirmed, basically, in this collection, though, that the Father of Swords is a Maker's Blade. It has the same sigil on the bottom.
Yeah, there's no way it wasn't. But yes.
I know. You'd hypothesize, and I was like, well, there's nothing to say that it is or isn't. And now it's like, okay, now I can say, you know, definitively.
Is it Shvedia that describes like a letter on the bottom of it or something like that?
No, it's actually Kerndon. Kra does.
Oh, but, okay. Yep. It is Kra. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. But regardless, I mean, the core point is, this seems actually magical by comparison.
Like, oh,
Father
for sure.
of Swords, a Maker's Blade, could be magical in other ways, but like,
is
a Maker's Blade.
Is for sure magical in the sharpening sense, in like its material composition, as opposed to its like effects.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's cool. But yeah, I mean, Skipping Town is a pretty straightforward. It's the shortest story. It's very close between that and Freedom as it happens. There's a lot of, at this point, because they've spent so much time together, there's also this great banter that goes back and forth that includes lots of jokes about Chambra's promiscuity, which is a funny character moment, but it's also like a serious sort of like lust that she has, which is a great character thing where it's like, it's actually, like, it's both a joke and it's also like not made light of, as like she actually genuinely like has these things and like seeks those kind of things. And it leads us to believe that maybe there's this sort of different relationship style. I'm curious, given the details that we get from Javra on Thond and a little bit from like the priestesses coming over, because the final confrontation of this is with a priestess, what culture do you feel like Thond most closely resembles? Given the 10,000 foot view that we get here, we don't get a whole lot.
I had not put any sort of thought to this.
Sure. I'll give you my impression and you can ring either way and say, I get the impression Thond feels very Greek to me. It feels very Greco-Roman in sort of the structure, in the language, in the philosophies, in the approaches as they're kind of like talking through them variously. Again, this sort of like sex positivity that happens on the part of Javra is very Greek in a lot of ways, generally reserved for men as opposed to women in history. So like a good adaptation, I think, in that way. Yeah, that was my impression.
On top of the religious aspect of it, or sort of some sort of orthodoxy or some sort of, Greek makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The religious orthodoxy is the one thing that randomly, and this is only because of the amount that I've studied like Mesoamerican and South American studies, actually leads me to believe more like an Aztec sort of thing, because priestesses and sort of the commonality there. But I'm still hard on the Greek thing.
There are Greek Orthodox.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. That's still, but it maybe doesn't align with
like
the way
the house
these...
of like Artemis and some of the other, like there are religions that existed over history, the cult of Artemis, excuse me, that that like absolutely were in that realm.
Yeah. And I think to pull from anything in the new world goes against what Joe talks about in the appendix a little bit. Or is it Stephen? I think Stephen Pacey is more the one that makes comment on that. So maybe that's not to be.
Joe's also said in interviews that like he is clearly like pulling inspiration from things, but simultaneously nothing is like a motto culture. Like that's kind of the, can't remember. I didn't listen to the final appendix this time just because I didn't have time within the week, but I had to read a whole nother book for book club. So I didn't have the time to listen to that strictly, but I've listened to a number of Joe interviews and I know that like his goal is not so much to like recreate a monoculture so much as it is to give things that evoke the feeling of something that exists already and like give you kind of a basis by which to like loosely handhold onto something, but not like fully grip deeply in on.
Mm-hmm.
So versus like Pierce, very clearly super Roman. We like get that. Yeah. You know, almost immediately.
I mean, that's explicit.
He's also dealing with like a near earth, so it's a little different, but yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's, yeah.
And they are emulating Roman society explicitly and intentionally.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Cool. Anything else on Skipping Town?
I don't think so. That it was a very quick burn of a chapter.
It's a pretty straightforward,
but little also short story. I think it's fair to point out that every single chapter with these two is mm-hmm. in a different country, except for the final one, I believe.
True.
We get Westport, near country. Is the near country technically a separate country?
Yeah. I mean, it's not the Empire and it's not the Union.
So. Yeah. The North. And then Styria. Mm-hmm. And then the final one is also Styria, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's I think that it's Talons and then Sapani.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're truly like hopping around the world in so many ways. So with that, we'll go into Two's a Company, though, which is one that we've already like begun to talk about to some degree, but like I think is the moment in which you get the most depth on Javra here, and also where I begin to adore Shvedia. This is the story in which like frustrations come to boil. It seems like this maybe isn't going to work out in some like sort of larger context as a friendship in the long run. But to read the summary here. So again, somewhere in the north, summer 576, Javra, lioness of Hoskop, runs into Cracknut Weirin on a bridge over a remote canyon, and Shev does her best to persuade them both to step aside, all before another fight with other Northmen break out, followed by a confrontation with a trio from the Golden Order of Thond.
Oh, lots of confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
In this. Kind of funny, like, three's a crowd feels mm-hmm. like it would the title of that would work so well here considering their meeting of Wurin on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But
I would agree, but I think that it points to the like love idea that's actually presented in Three's a Crowd, so like it's a little bit different.
Yeah,
two's company is actually used more like you're just fucking him right now, it's not that big of a deal, versus Three's a Crowd is like I can't have that relationship, in part because that relationship sucks. I'm not going to continue that. But also, like, it's crowded out the other things in my life that I shouldn't care about and be paying attention to. Because, right. Javra is one of whom is willing to indulge in many ways, as we kind of learn. But also, simultaneously, if Shev would have been around and, like, encouraging and, like, working with her and, like, being the friend, she wouldn't have done that to the same degree that we did that we find her in that story, in that moment. Not that it's like fully out of character, not that it's even negative for her, but she wouldn't have stalled in her life in that way necessarily. So that's right. That's where I find the titles as they relate.
I think I agree. I remember thinking that the first time I was reading through Two's Company, like, oh, I know, like, I already knew Three's a Crowd, and maybe that was a mistake on my part, having looked through the titles.
No.
But thinking, like, Three's a Crowd would have been a great name for this, because of, like, this really important meeting on this bridge.
I would agree, and I get that. And to talk about the bridge itself, obviously, this is the bridge. We're back in the north. It's really interesting. There's this fun note here as well, that this was literally mentioned in The Heroes offhandedly as, like, wait, wasn't there, like, a moment wherein where you defended this bridge with, like, a woman and a boy? And I think it's Droft that brings it up as, like, They're sitting at the fire near the end. And he's like, well, it's not quite what happened. And we, like, don't quite get that. But here it is. Here's the scene.
So intensely curious about the order of operations in Joe's head.
What do you mean? Like, when he built what?
When he built this story. When this story materialized in his brain. Whether or not it was on page or not.
Sure.
Whether or not it was on... You know what I mean.
Whether or not this was written first or otherwise.
Not necessarily written, but understood to be the background on Wirin's character. Or if that was a throwaway line that then turned into this story and got connected later on.
What do they call these? I think the trope, as this is named, is like noodle event or something like that, where it's like, this one time I killed a guy with noodles. It's based on, like, either, I think it's a manga trope that originally existed, where it's like, you don't want to know, or like, you're not sure about where that initial event comes from, and often explaining it can be to the detriment of, like, the reference, if that makes sense. Like, it's a thing that's referenced to, like, show that the world is deeper than it is without you actually knowing what the thing that is there is deeper. My experience with those kind of things, generally speaking, is that most people don't write them first. They write them later. That said, the standalones were all constructed in such a weird state where, like, Joe was also, some of these stories were published in other magazines first. Some of them were published, you know, magazine publishing in anthologies. For instance, I believe that the final Kharkov story was originally published in Dangerous Women, which was another anthology that Brandon Sanderson published a short story in as well. It was all, like, women point of views, and it was meant to be, like, this whole thing. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Truth be told, I don't know on this one specifically. But I do personally, my gut says that he wrote The Heroes first and then came back and wrote this, by comparison, to a village near Barden, of which I do think was axed from the story. I think a village near Barden feels too much like The Heroes.
I agree. And we'll talk about that when we get there.
Yeah.
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 Because I think I've got a lot to talk about that.
Cool.
Specifically.
Yeah. Sure. Makes sense for me. Yeah, this is a hysterical story in so many ways. There's this, like, muscly standoff that we have between Wirin and Javra. They hold their own against each other in, like, a bare-knuckle brawl. It becomes this, like, attraction thing. They fuck. And Chev is in her most, like, despotic state of the entire story in this moment, which is just like, I fucking hate everything. All I'm hearing is slapping over wet stone as the rain is on me. It feels like an R-rated version of a lot of the shit that happens in The Emperor's New Groove. It's just so much. It's so much of the llama sadness.
Oh, you know, my what I mean? God.
It's Kuzco sadness.
Now I...
God, you can't help but see it.
There's absolutely a cut scene where Kuzco is... Kuzco, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is listening to...
Kuzco and Kronk, yeah.
Kronk fuck someone behind a boulder. Like,
yeah. And Pacha, right? And Pacha is the person that he's with and, like, traveling with all the time. But absolutely. I mean, like
that scene,
my God.
That scene just existed and was animated and was cut.
Yeah. Because they're like, wait, it's PG. Oh, no. Yeah, man. That's every time I reread this one, I cannot get that image out of my head.
That's,
it's just
so,
like,
fucked, Crossland. Now that's all I'll think about.
It's just Chev in the rain, moppy hair over top face, just like sad Kuzco Llama right at the beginning of the movie.
Just listening to balls slap against butt cheeks.
There's just the clapping, right? It's the flesh. It's like Joe gets so into it in this one as she's like, my God, I'm so... And I think it's in part because like Chev's monologue is also like, I mean, she's a lesbian. She does not, this is not something that is attractive to her, but she also like understands. She's like, I need the groaning to stop though. I cannot handle the groaning, the moaning. It's too much. And then she's like, hey, shut the fuck up as the Northmen show up.
I don't think sexual orientation comes into dislike of listening to other people fuck.
That's very true. I think it's just specifically the slapping in that way that like there's just this like off-putting edge.
And you know the way she describes Wirin's grunting also.
Right.
Or Wirin's groaning. It's yeah.
and Casey's narration of the whole thing is just it's so fucking perfect. Oh man, so
good.
It's such a perfect like set of comedic beats, and I adore it in so many different ways. So yeah, it's good. Then Flood shows up with a bunch of Northmen, and Flood, of course, being the guy of whom recruited Beck, rejoins Kern and Cross crew.
That's kind of a through line in this.
Yeah. He's not in full jobs at that point because he's left the crew, but.
No, but he is in the final. Isn't Flood with Tunny and Yoke?
Forrest.
Oh, it's Forrest. Okay.
Yeah. Forrest, Tunny, Yoke. Yeah, the Union boys.
God, of course it's not.
But like a lot of this, truth be told, a lot of this is like connective tissue to the heroes and Best of Cold. Less is Red Country, some is Red Country. But
there's a little bit of Red Country, but it's mostly kind of...
It's Temple and Shy, pretty much.
Yeah. And a little bit of commentary from Chev.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Freedom. So maybe there's more than I think that there is, but...
There is Freedom, yeah.
I get more heroes in Best of Cold from this, but...
Freedom was something... I was expecting something completely different.
We'll talk about Freedom in a moment when we get to the next little segment here. So they fend off the Northmen, kill a lot of them. It's a cool fight scene, as is traditional with Abercrombie. It's really well written as they kind of like complain. They get back to fucking. And then the Golden Order shows up with sort of, I think it's three women at this point out of the 12, as some have been promoted since the death. And there's this other cool like fight that happens where they're using these really unique weapons again, which also happened during the last fight. And it ends and they go across the bridge. That's it.
That's it. They just go across the bridge.
That's it, dude. They kind of continue traveling together for a while. And she's like, my God.
Yeah. what is the politeness of deciding to go to Thond versus Carleon?
Yeah, as they're like arguing and back and forth about like
what side of the bridge to fight on and mm-hmm. all of that. The chivalry of it was really, really fucking funny.
Yeah, there's this other thing too of where like neither of them want to go home for various reasons. I mean,
right.
Obviously, it's because like he's getting hunted and she's also getting hunted, which is why they're fighting on this bridge, you know, at the same time, same moment, they're caught. Which is kind of a cool, I mean, it's a cool moment. It adds to the myth of Wirin and Bly in an excellent way, in my opinion. And I...
For sure.
Any additional moments with Wirin are great. Oh, texted me.
I did. I called you.
Yeah.
I called you. Yeah. You were with Bingham. And you thought I had something more important to talk about. And I did. I didn't.
He just calls you to say that shit? And I was like, not usually. usually text me.
No, I would have kept, like... I was driving, so I called, and then I got a phone call from my wife, so I took her call instead.
Naturally,
I dropped you to talk to her.
Bingham wasn't offended at all. Just kidding.
Good. but I called because I knew I'd forget to text you by the time I got home, because I knew it was such like a small thing. But it was saying, they call me crack nut because my nuts cracked, and that's a fact, or whatever.
That's literally the line. It's, yep.
Yeah.
Nuts cracked, that's a fact. Yeah.
It rhymes, and I don't think it should, but it's how I remember it. Like, I don't think it doesn't compute that it's a rhyme for me, for some reason, but it does. But throughout all of this, he knows he completely understands the background on his name. So him like
it does change the joke in the heroes. Yeah.
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 Totally changes that joke.
Which makes it more of a joke, where he's like, oh, I thought it was that I could crack a nut in my hand, as though he was trying to like downplay his insanity, you know, or is like his being named for like being crazy.
It makes it funnier also in that
I would agree.
In addition, at the end, when Wonderful calls him Cracknut, or somebody else calls him Cracknut, I think it's Wonderful.
I think it's, yeah.
He doesn't actually like have words with them for it.
No. And he just like, he plays it off the first time. He's like, well, I thought it was that I could crack a walnut in my hand. And he kind of like explains it. It becomes this like joke. And this leans into the full job story, in which everyone thinks that he's very serious and like he's portraying himself as very serious. And then he laughs and it freaks everyone out because he's like laughing very heartily. And it's like, no, the guy's funny. He's just uncomfortable because he doesn't know you guys yet. Like, and there's this like interesting kind of character beat there where it's like, he just wants friends. He's just mostly a normal dude with like a couple of wires crossed, but like not that off, you know?
Yeah.
Makes for a more wholesome picture of Weirin throughout the entire story, and I love that.
Totally agree.
Yeah. It also makes the cheese trap an even more brilliant invention.
It's such a... Crossland.
I love cheese traps. I have cheese traps all the time. Actually, I don't, because I just eat chicken, beans, broccoli right now, but...
There's something truly magical about grilled cheese sandwiches, Crossland.
Truly. Yes. I love grilled cheese sandwiches. You have to cut them diagonally, though. If you cut them in the middle, you're fucked up. We can't talk.
I totally agree. If
you don't cut them, it's okay.
No, I agree. Yep.
Okay.
You got to get the point. You need the point.
Yeah. It's true. More surface area for the dip and like deeper dips. Come on.
But homemade sourdough with like,
oh my God.
Like as a grilled cheese sandwich base, fucking perfect.
Incredible. Incredible. All right. With that in mind, we're going to get into Theresa Craft.
That's not even part of this book.
No. But I got to keep steering the ship because I'm afraid that this episode will go really long if I don't.
You sure you don't want to pour yourself another cocktail?
The drink break comes up after this, and maybe I'll make it old fashioned. I don't know. You don't at me, bro.
I probably should too, because mine's.
Oh, you did make. I mean, it was only an old fashioned, but yeah,
it's the same amount of alcohol as a normal cocktail.
Not my cocktail, bro.
Yours, yeah. Yours is fucked. We'll get there.
It was boozy. Okay, cool. With that, Three's a Crowd, the final ish story here with Chivetti and Javra. It's not actually the last one, but it's close. This is Talon's Autumn 587. So this is over a decade after the last story. So we have a big time jump that happens here as we consider their plot line through this. Most of this story takes place in order chronologically, outside of the beginning with Glockta and the end with Logan. Everything else is chronological.
Is it totally?
I feel like
there were a couple other things, but
I threw my phone over there so I can't check the audible very easily. But hang on.
No, you don't have to look it up. I believe you. I just, for some reason, thought it was jumping more than that.
I'm like 98%.
I thought there were some like fours, like four.
Nothing takes place in four.
It's all five. Yeah.
Yeah. 592. Yeah, they're all in order outside of those two.
Okay.
So, core point being is that it's mostly easy to follow outside of those as like nice bookends from a character perspective of like, oh, you open up the book and you see Glockta on the front page. That's cool. And when you close the book, the Logan story is a completely different thing that we'll talk about. But So this takes place very late, though, in the full collection, is all that I'm trying to point out here. The entirety of the standalones have passed in the interim as well. So that's an important thing to note as we move along the timeline. Again, Talon's Autumn 587. And the summary here, it's a foolish man who steals from the best thief in Styria. And when Horold, the Finger, steals her lover, it's time for Shev to stop running and start fighting. For those who work in the shadows, though, few things are ever quite as they seem. And this is a very mysterious thing. This is the longest story by a lot. This is almost 2 hours, if I recall correctly, in audiobook form.
It is. It's like an hour 52 or something like that.
Yeah. Very, very long. The only other one that I think gets close is the Kharkov one, which is another Shev adjacent story. Everything else is kind of like around 30 to 50 minutes, you know, generally speaking, from that chapter length, or, you know, a couple dozen pages. But it's interesting. This one covers a lot of ground to start off with. Vitari and yes. Lanza overlooking the crowning of King Jappo. Jappo being the son of Manza.
You said Vitari and Manza overlooking.
Sorry. Yeah. Shev.
Vitari and Shev. Yeah.
Yep.
And Shev remarking on how traveled of a person she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Around the whole of the circle of the world.
Probably not a wrong estimation to say that she's one of the most well-traveled women in the world.
Almost certainly. Yeah. And as such,
one of the few people that we could point to is your favorite character. Brother Longfoot?
Yeah.
One of the few rivals in this. I love him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But truly, she has been in every single continent that we've had a major play in.
And as a part of that, has had fingers in the various pies, like you said earlier. Like she's met Shivers, which we kind of talked about a little bit.
We talked about Sapani
think
that,
guards.
That's where this is where that comes up, right?
Yeah.
So my read on that was that she was helping Shivers with something for Manza.
Oh, I didn't get that.
No?
My read on that is that Take this as conspiracy brain, okay? I just need you to accept that, because this series also doesn't have the firm answer. So I'm just gonna lay it out here for you. My opinion on that is that he cursed off Styria. He said he was never going to return, you know, in so many words. And also Manza said, "Don't you dare ever return." I am a believer that he came back, ran into her in Sapani, helped her fend off those guards because he was returning to maybe meet his son and wanted to figure out a way to do that because he was a believer that was the case. I don't know. I can't think of any other compelling reason that Shivers would come back to Styria.
Speaking of Shivers,
which is King Jappo, maybe.
Probably. Seems like he doesn't speak Northern. Seems like he has two eyes. So I think I have to drink for a bet that I made.
I am holding that bet. The one thing I'll say, I'm not going to make you drink here. And I'm going to put that out here. The reason I'm not going to make you drink here is because we do very soon. You will eventually get to meet this character at least once. And that will be the impression in the moment.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to spoil beyond that. You'll get a clearer answer way or another.
Would
I'm
you
not
like to
an
read the verbiage?
Well, okay.
Of the bet,
okay.
Though.
Yeah. Because I actually, you're right. Because you made me change it. Because I wrote something very plain that was trying to give you more credit. The verbiage is ridiculous. And I specifically have in giant text, "Hold this bet" over top of it, which is crazy. So she makes a plan as well to take Etrasani by siege, and her advisors leave, letting her reflect on what's to be done and also on the fact that she's pregnant with either Rogan or Shiver's child. I rarely force bets, but PJ, I'd love for you to make your mark despite Monza's reaction. It doesn't matter because it's hers. And you said,
"That little bastard is coming out with one eye and a northern accent."
Yeah. Okay. Which, you know, okay, if you want to drink for him not speaking Northern, sure.
And having two eyes. Well, I feel like it would be remarked upon if he had one eye.
It's true. It's true.
And also, that's not a genetic thing.
Yeah.
Neither is the Northern accent thing. But I, you know what? I'm going to drink for it anyway.
Okay.
We can put it back in as like the spirit of the guess. The spirit of the guess is that it shivers his child.
Right.
And I will hold that bet for later. But I feel like drinking for this right now.
In the immediate, I understand. Also, this has maybe been the longest standing bet on the show.
No. No, we've had
really?
we've had no. I feel like we had something early in Red Rising.
Yeah, but those were kind of like false promises of hope in a weird That's way. That it's fair. Like
good point. Yeah.
I kind of I mean
You're right. I don't want to It has been it has been four books.
Yeah. It's been a bit, including this one. So it's right there. I think on a page count level, it's probably at least, but
yeah.
Okay, returning to Three's a Crowd, though, King Joppo is getting crowned here in Monskara Mikado, having done a great job leading the country for this long, probably continuing to lead it as this kid is crowned, of course. But
at least a decade?
Yeah, at least a decade, given the story.
Or no, eight years. 8 years. Because Joppo is 7.
Yes. Sounds about right.
Or 9 years and Joppo's 8. Something.
It's something close to that. It's near a decade that she's been in charge of Styria. At the very least, I mean, she was even under Orso, was kind of in charge of Styria variously.
Well, but like, yes. But I mean, as far as
her actual, past, like,
her reign.
Duchessdom. Yeah.
Duchessnessdom.
Duchessnessdom. As she was like looking over it. Incredible. This brief flirtation of seeing Monza. I love this story so much. I love the Best of Cold. I want the more of the Best of... We don't get that much of Best of Cold in this compilation by comparison, but I do appreciate the parts that we get. And this is one of them. It's kind of a long-term payoff. So that said, we see that Shvedia, within the decade, has also settled into a relationship of a kind with Kharkov, although very uncertain in a lot of different ways. She like speaks of pearl dust as well, and like just kind of like getting into a weekend of like hanging out, getting high on drugs, and like fucking. Like, I she's mean, like, I just want my person. I want to be at home.
Hey, man. I can't knock that. That sounds pretty dope.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm
sure
far off from that being something that I would indulge in, but that's your proclivity. Only that like sounds like a great time.
At least 18 years.
Well, fair.
I at mean, a minimum.
Even before child, that has been. It's been a while since that's been like.
No, yeah. Right. I'm not yeah. making like fully bits here. I'm just
now,
saying like.
Now it can't be, but.
Very true. Right. I do want to note that I just also think that it's like kind of this like sort of somber moment from Shev's own perspective as we like think about the way that like she really wants love. That's like the core of her story in so many ways. Like she desires and needs companionship, and she was seeking in the wrong places. And we'll get into that as we like resolve the end of the story. But like that's what's kind of set up and teed up for us at the beginning of this part, but also those seeds are laid throughout the rest of this. Like she just loves that friendship that she has so much and so deeply. So the house is broken into, so many of these different things are stolen. There's a note that's left. Also, she's been forgiven by Harald the Finger as well, which is such like an interesting note that comes, and it's like this very pure forgiveness, but then her house is broken into, very strange. All the spoons are bent, which is such like a weird detail.
Everything, every little,
everything's broken, but then the spoons are bent. I don't know why I can't get over the spoon bending thing.
Like, Yuri Geller got into her house. But yeah, she remarks upon this like contract, asking if this is legally binding. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, yeah, it kind of is. And also, Horold also views it as, yeah, this is kind of legally binding, but I'm going to skirt this law as much as I can.
Yeah, which is interesting because it appears, I mean, when we get into the, like, the detail in so many ways, I think that Kharkov did a lot of damage herself. Like, this is self-inflicted. I don't think that there were any thugs. I think that's why it's so specific in its damage, because that would be personal and intentional. So that is him skirting the law very effectively by it being self-inflicted. But as such, she realizes that, like, her love is in danger. She has, like, one last job, kind of, not exactly, but is like, I need your help desperately. And I'm pleading. She finds Javra in this hole in a wall with these three men, of whom are wasted and high out of their minds, drinking cards. She's been drinking way too much and is effectively worthless for the entirety of this plot, which is also so funny. But those three dudes are Forrest, Tunney, and Yoke. And it's the best cameo of the entire set of
it's so good
stories. Yeah.
Fucking Yoke.
Fucking Yoke. I raise.
I raise.
As he's like waking up in the middle of it because he's falling asleep. Oh, it's so good.
He's just asleep the whole time. And
there have been moments.
Go ahead. The commentary on them dragging Yoke away, him raising all the while.
Yeah.
It's fuck, so dude. Good. It's so good.
Yeah, it's also nice to see, like, Forrest, like, fall in with Tunney, you know, because they always, especially at the end of the Heroes.
We get, like, a couple, Tunney cameos here.
What's the other Tunney cameo?
He is Glockta's
Right. Yeah.
He's Glockta's lackey. What would you call him?
The name is used as servant. He's his, they say servant, but he's also Corporal Tunney at that point. But he is, I mean,
Squire. Like Squire is kind of what I think of.
I was going to say attendant, but Squire is more accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot about that one for some reason. It's definitely written in the notes, but I was like, spaced my part. It's so funny. All that said, we get to the sort of like agreement that they have between the pair of them, and they decide that they're going to break into this island. There's like this mini kind of like setup. They steal a boat, in which like Javra throws like a big fit about the idea of stealing a boat. There's this very emotional moment in which Shev is like, she has like a great internal emotional dialogue, but she almost never externalizes it. And here she's like, I need this. This is like the part of me that I like need to pursue. And I know that you don't like her, but like, please help me. And like an incredible friend, Javra agrees to help. However, Javra is wasted, and so is no help.
She's no help. But honestly, I think the most interesting part of this, like, she's kind of hot and cold about it, until Tunney doesn't even threaten Shvedia, but just kind of talks at her aggressively.
Oh, yeah. And then she lashes out. Yeah.
Javra's like, don't you fucking talk to my friend that way. And like, from that point forward, she's on board. And like, it's been over a decade. It's been, I think, as she points out, 12 years since they've seen each, or since they've met each other. You and I have known each other for 12 years. You and I have known each other for more than that. But
it's probably like 15 years. I mean, realistically, known each other for like 17 years, but like we're friends for 14, I would say. Probably about right.
Yeah, probably.
14 or 15, 31.
Somewhere in there. Whatever it is. But that's a long time.
Yeah.
Like, I can count on one hand the number of friends that I have that fall into that category. I think most people of our age are probably in the same boat. Like, to know someone for that long is a special thing, I think. And to still be able to call them a friend.
Yeah. And to, like, still care very deeply and being like, I'm always there for you kind of a thing, which is sort of the depth of this story in a way. it's part of the reason that I think that the story works so well. So I don't want to get to the end to like spoil that sort of like note or mention. Actually, no, fuck it. This is like a short story context, whatever. That's what wraps this up and makes it feel so emotional in the very end is when Shvedia decides to leave Kharkov for her friend, of whom, like, she cares about Kharkov. But is it more than just that sort of, like, attraction? Is it more? And also, like, does she really know her on a deeper level with the letters and everything else that were being passed between? There's so many, like, lies and layers and everything else versus, like, the honesty and the depth of friendship that exists there with someone that she has cared about for so long. You know, that's one of those substantive differences that she like leans into. And so she ventures out to follow her friend instead and find her and support her in her needing to thieve something back for Thond.
It's a great, which it's we such a what. Good story. It's such a good story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. We're not done talking about the pair of them yet. And also I want to go back to kind of the reveal of the story, but I do hope that within the next set of standalones, there's this like bitter hope that I have that Joe would consider going back to flesh out whatever that theft is for Thond. That's the story that I want. Mm. There are no other, and I mean this very genuinely, in all of the original trilogy, in the sequels, in everything else, there is no other story that I like really need. Like, I, there are interesting things that are interesting details that could be fun to get.
Yeah.
The story that I would like is a full Shev Javra story. That's what I desire more than anything else.
Yeah, I agree. I totally, totally agree.
Or just like a novella or like a couple of short stories. Like, you could fill it out shortly. It doesn't
is he working on or is he planning on more standalones?
He said it's likely that he returns to standalone, at least a standalone first before he would go into like another trilogy or anything like that. He has also said in general that he's not immediately heading back into the First Law. He's probably writing the next Devil's sequel. But those are also kind of treated as like standalone entries as well. So like they're not like there's a chronology to them, but ultimately that's not going to like be a thing, if that makes sense.
Okay, but it's not off the table, and it's
no, he's talked about his first idea, which is a train robbery.
Hmm.
So.
Okay. I haven't heard of a train in this story.
Well, I know. We've got a whole nother trilogy here.
That's
and we've begun to play fair. With coal. Yeah.
Right. Good point.
But yeah, so it could be interesting.
To your point, though, and there are three books staring at me from the shelf above me right now that may say otherwise, but so far we have, as we mentioned, very little exposure to Thond. Mm-hmm. So if that continues to be the case, this feels like a perfect opportunity for a standalone.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. I think that it is a perfect opportunity for a standalone. I think it's also, again, the only flashbacky standalone from the timeline that I would want. I don't, for instance, at this point, we have nothing on Pharaoh and the South.
That's
Pharaoh and
true.
The South could be really interesting, potentially, but I don't know that I need it. I want this standalone, though. I want this story. That's a very different feeling. Like, I'm intrigued by the idea of like what Pharaoh does in the South and like how that comes to pass in some way, shape, or form. We don't know what that shape looks like, you know, at this point. But I don't know that I need it. I do want Javra and Shev though, badly.
I think I 100% align with your thoughts there.
Cool. Okay, to wrap up this story, which is to talk about the like the 75% point. So there's this incredible scene that happens as she is mounting the balustrade and is like coming up over the balcony. She sees this man eye to eye, and this is where we get like the most action movie-y, like spy movie-y of like all of these. She's got this needle dart in her mouth and she just like reaches up over the balcony, stabs it into him like roughly through the side. It's such a cool like little moment. Yeah. Leads into a great conflict in which we see Chev as like a warrior in a way that we hadn't beforehand, where like she manages and handles all these people using toxins, using knives, knocking them out variously. Very, to use like a Marvel reference in the middle of this for no apparent reason, very Black Widow adjacent, like very spy thriller-y in a way that's fun.
There's the really big fucker. Big long?
Log. Big loud. Something like that. Big something or other. Big L.
Yeah. I didn't read this one physically. I just listened to it. So I thought it was big long. Like, but I'm not sure. Yeah, he gets, she, God, it's so fucking funny when she's throwing those knives. She's got a bunch of them. She whiffs her coat open and like has all of them. And
it's like Matrix, but knives. Yeah.
But the comment is her accuracy was nowhere near as close as her speed or something to that effect. Like, she's just not that good at throwing knives, but she's really fast at it.
It doesn't fucking matter. Like, he gets one fucking hit me with any of them.
And he gets hit with one.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that it's nothing like a lethal, like, stab wound because it's poisoned.
It's sleep specifically. It's a sleep toxin. So yeah. He doesn't die. He's asleep. She kills and poisons a number of people here, but for whatever reason, big guy just gets put down. He's just napping.
He's just napping. He's the napping. Only one that's hit with those throwing knives, though. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun.
Play to your strengths. Play what you've got.
Right. And it's so much fun because then Chavra comes up over the balcony, like just kind of like very
still fucking wasted.
Just swings one hip over and is like kind of like, oh, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Just there.
So there's something about Chavra. It takes her several days to get drunk.
Yeah.
Like several days of straight drinking to get drunk and seemingly a decent amount of time to get sober as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What was interesting is that Chev talked about not only the drunkenness and like how long it took her to get drunk, but like she used stages as well to describe her sobriety, where it was like sober or clean. And clean is like acceptable, Chavra, it seemed, versus like sober was like impossible.
Yeah.
Cool moment in among the rest. Chavra, queen drinker of the group. Cheers to Chavra.
Cheers to Chavra. You know what I
mean? Yeah. All this said,
I think just finished.
We did our back half beers in the first half. I mean,
We've been talking for like 2.5 hours.
Truly. Yes. Yeah. We've been recording for an hour and a half.
Two hours.
Yeah. We just need to acknowledge as well that these episodes are just going to be longer.
They will be
as we tackle more, and not that badly, but whatever. I want to mention as well that this is one of those like betrayals that I didn't see coming. I think that this is one of another clever like underhanded thing where it's like I didn't see Kharkov being abducted. Like I genuinely thought it was abduction. I was with through the entire way with Chev, and the reveal that this was meant to be more of like a. No, I just wanted you to show up, and like we're all paying off each other's debts variously, and really, this is about Chavra. You know,
I saw the betrayal coming.
Sure,
like the betrayal of Kharkov. I didn't see it in this way.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think Kharkov cared about Chavra or about Chev, but I thought she was genuinely abducted. Because I thought Horold knew that this was a pressure point for Chevedia. And that's all that matters in scenarios like this.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what Kharkov's like proclivities and plans are.
Mm-hmm. Right. it's just interesting from that perspective of like, oh shit, well, like, there was, it, even as you read the letter, and when you reread it, the letter is actually not as sinister as it appears. It's actually much more honest. Like, we're going to be like drinking wine and thinking about you and like the various things. Like, it's very like, you're forgiven, show up, I have her, we're going to be drinking and laughing. And like, it's very innocuous when you understand the context, but it also feels very Bond villainy if you take it as an evil thing, which is a natural impression that Chev would have in that moment. Like, it's meant to evoke that response. Don't get me wrong.
But also, like, she also killed his son.
Right. But legally, she was forgiven beforehand, to the point that we've already...
Yes, heard. Yes, but... She killed his son. It has been 12 or 10 years since that happened. 12 years. 12 years since mm-hmm. that happened. And... things tend to come to roost.
It's true.
Especially in Joe's stories.
Yeah. So, but it didn't this time because he has 11 kids.
He's like, no, he was a fucker.
Which is a funny joke that mirrors a joke earlier that Javra made about like when they stole the boat, being like, well, daddy can't afford food anymore because for his 12 kids, because we stole the boat. And she's like, motherfucker, Chev is like, motherfucker, you're the one of whom breaks the boat so that we can't return it to begin with. And it's a nice, again, like a very clever and great exchange between them. I love it. Yeah. We already talked most about, we didn't talk about the Priestess of Thawne showing up. So in the end, as this kind of story climaxes, the Priestess of Thawne, her mother shows up, and as well as a number of the other sort of
her mother
order. Yeah.
That was a fun review.
Mom. Which is very interesting. Also, it's interesting that she knows that she can't control her and is accepted the fact that she's killed all these different Golden Order members and is like, no, I'm not trying to bring you back in. I just need you to do a thing for me. Since you're unwilling to come back in, I just need your help, which is a very different sort of plot twist on like the whole
but
thing as well.
For both of them.
Yeah. Like,
you're assuming retribution is coming for both of these characters, and the mm-hmm. same plot twist hit me the same way both times.
Yeah, twice. You know, it like this story packs so many punches within it. And that is why I am in desperate need of the story of what they liberate or like what they do. Like, I assume it's an Indiana Jones standalone. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like that kind of a thing, which would be very fun for the pair of them to go on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love that. Would love that. I actually want to double check the timeline. Tell Time's All Over is 592, so, you know, years later. So there's time to have that adventure within that space. I just want to know. I want to know, because clearly it went well enough for them to still be friends when we see them again in a bit. Although maybe, you know, friends, but a little bit, like, adjacent in a way.
Something like
not
that.
Not directly involved, but friends, yeah. We'll get into it more when we talk about that one. Anything else on this beastie of a short story?
I don't think so. It's a big one.
It's the longest one. I mean, this is two chapters of most books that we read. So, or most of First Law. All right, cool. Well, with that, let's get into our drinks that we not only finished, but our back halves that we finished as well before we grab whatever we're going to drink for the back half of this episode. PJ, what was your cocktail?
I made something that we haven't talked about yet, or named after something we haven't talked about yet. So I made a cocktail that I named Bethod's Legacy, Peace in the North, which is effectively a chaga old fashioned. So chaga mushroom is something that exists in this world and is spelled differently than the chaga mushroom.
I didn't even consider that connection at all. That's incredible. It's so much better than I thought. Holy shit. Well done. Great idea.
You didn't realize that's what I was doing?
Nope. I didn't get it. Okay. I didn't get it. Incredible. I love it.
Chaga, Chaga, for us is not, it's a mushroom, for those of you who are not familiar with it, which I think is still the case in this story.
I get the sense that it's tobacco, but
yeah, but it's orange, and so is the chaga mushroom.
Is it orange?
Yes, it's orange.
Okay, continue.
You're gonna search this.
I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah, but anyway, I wanted to make something with chaga for Bethod. So I did a chaga old fashioned, which
is a fungus. You're so fucking right. Oh no, combination of both marijuana and tobacco as described. Okay.
Yep. Anyway, 2 ounces of whiskey. I use the Calumet 15, which is too good of a whiskey to use in any sort of cocktail that but it's the only whiskey I had.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
10 drops of chaga mushroom extract, which I made myself. So chaga is a mushroom that grows on birch trees very slowly. And there's a whole lot of birch trees near my in-laws' house. So we collected pounds and pounds of chaga. And we turned it into a couple gallons of extract. And I put it in my coffee, but I also thought it'd be fun to make a cocktail with it. So 10 drops of that extract and then a bar spoon of simple syrup just to make this
old fashioned.
Very simple, but very earthy and strong and delicious. So peace in the North.
Peace in the North. That's good. It's a good emblematic thing. I truly hadn't considered the chaga connection until this.
That's
exact
really
moment.
Funny.
And we talked about it before we had drank anything. So that's crazy.
Yeah.
Cool. What was your backup beer?
It was Molecular Effect, which is a New England IPA from Grist House out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Ooh, nice. Nice. Yeah. One of those. It's a cool little label.
Yeah, it's a fun beer.
Yeah.
Cool. So, Crossland, what are you drinking tonight? Or what did you drink tonight?
Yeah, so far, I made a cocktail that I originally had intended to be like aimed at Chevetia, and it was going to be a fun joke based on like this first part of the story. And I was like, you know, going to be like Chevetia, Javra's partner, you know, or like, what'd she say? The line is sidekick.
Henchman.
And then henchman. And then it's not until this last story in which Javra leads off when she says, I'm her sidekick, where Javra comes back and says, she's my partner. And it's such like a heartwarming moment. So I wanted to make a cocktail that was emblematic of that. While I was thinking about making the cocktail, I went, okay, Javra is a boozy gal. She's going to drink all this booze. And so I made a boozy cocktail. Then I went, wait. I was supposed to make a cocktail for Chev. Like, this is not the way that I wanted to go. So I made an incredible cocktail, though, for Javra. So I think that that's a good celebration. I'm calling it the Lioness of Hoskop Punch. I feel like that's very relevant, given kind of the context. There's only one fruit ingredient, so it's not technically a punch, but leave me alone. The recipe here, 2 ounces of Japanese Suntory gin.
This recipe's
1 ounce. It's fucked. It's so tasty, though. So 2 ounces of Japanese gin, 1 ounce of the Smith & Cross, like slightly more proof Navy strength rum, 1 ounce of tequila, 1 ounce of dry curacao, 1 ounce of lemon juice, 1 ounce of orgeo, and 2 dashes of bitters and a spritz of absinthe on top from my little atomizer. And PJ, this is like a top 10 cocktail. It shouldn't be, and it is, unfortunately.
It's really pretty.
It was very pretty.
It's such a stupid amount of booze.
It's mostly booze. That's why you're like, you should get another cocktail. And I'm like, I don't think I should.
That is why I said it, because it's so much booze. But also, it's Jesus Christ, dude.
It's so good. It's so good. I mean, genuinely, like, it's so flavorful. And bitters, of course, not just general bitters. Angostura is what I used initially. I did have to reshake it because it, because of my orgeo, it unincorporated. Yeah. And so I had to reshake it to like reincorporate everything. And then it kind of stayed. But I blame that mostly on older orgeo than anything else.
Part of it is older orgeo. And part of it is orgeo is not typically used in such a high concentrated, like high volume.
That's fair. Generally, you're using it with like pineapple juice, so it like generally filters down through the cocktail a little
and
bit.
And you're
better.
Using like a quarter ounce or a half ounce at a time. I love Orgeau and I like using it instead of Simple, but it does tend to separate when you're using more of it in a cocktail.
Super fair. Super fair. Following that up, I had a Belgian Blonde from Flytrap Brewing Company, which was incredible. It's delightful. It's unfortunate that they don't make as many Belgians because they aren't quite as popular in general, but they do keep the Belgian Blonde on and they do their Belgian Triple every once in a while. So every time that either of them are on, I got to get one or two. And this was a great time to get one. So it is.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was tasty. I'm going to have a pernicious hazy, I think, on the back half. So
I'll see what I wrangle up in this intervening break.
Okay. So with our cocktails and back half beers out of the way, next week we are going to be covering all of part two and part three of Sharp Ends. So I kind of broke these up into weird segments, but basically read the rest of it. If you've read those components of Sharp Ends, or if you've read any of it, you know, just make sure that you've read it all before next week as it goes there. with that in mind, I also want to real quickly do our kind of normal outro here and just say, hey, thank you so much for listening to the show. Leave us a review wherever you can, wherever you prefer, and follow us on social media. I've been a bit more active on Blue Sky lately, kind of choosing that as the home, a little bit here and there on Threads, but really been enjoying kind of the community and culture over there. So follow us on whatever platform you prefer. You can generally find us Words Whiskey Pod or wordsinwhiskey.show on Blue Sky itself. And their penchant for stuff. If you want to keep up with our up-to-date schedule, that's also available. The episode following the Sharp Ends episode is going to be a full wrap-up on The Great Leveler with Josh Ramsey. So very excited to have that conversation. So, you know, return for Sharp Ends, the rest of it next week, week following that, and then we'll get kicked off with The Age of Madness. Which I'll tell you right now, PJ and I have already recorded our first couple of episodes and fucking love it. So, all right. Talk to you later.